Well, our subject matter, as you just heard, is the impact of state antitrust enforcement. And this has been something that's very much in evidence and prominent in the last couple of years, I would say, maybe a little more than that, with the state attorneys general coordinating among themselves and announcing a wide-ranging investigation in the generic drug industry in terms of price fixing. Participating in numbers, I think perhaps about 14 or more participated in their own brought their own case to stop the T-Mobile merger. So these have been high profile matters, and there are several others, of course. So that's the general topic. We're going to start by everyone's credentials are behind me, by the way. I assure you, they all went to law school.
No, Tuck, I didn't go to law school.
Oh, wait a minute, Bruce. Oh, no, pardon me. Either went to or teaches at a law school.
Yeah.
So we will begin by hearing from George Carey at some length.
All right. Thank you, Judge. So this is the first panel after lunch, and I'm going to try to make it lively enough to keep everybody awake. Evan said that he was afraid this was going to deteriorate into a discussion of T-Mobile, and he wanted to avoid that, so I'm going to talk about T-Mobile. So let me tell you a little bit about T-Mobile first, and then I will segue into the topic of the panel. T-Mobile, Sprint, two of the four network carriers in the United States, a transaction creating an enterprise value of about $160 billion, first announced April 2018. Key metrics. As a result of putting these two networks together, from fewer inputs than the combined companies, you end up with twice the capacity of the network, three times the amount of 5G capacity. You end up with a network 15 times faster, and you do all that at a cost that is marginal cost one-seventh of what the marginal cost of the standalone companies are. In other words, much more output, much lower cost, much more competitive company. Now, when I first said that, everybody gasped and said that couldn't possibly be true. We now have a U.S. District Court opinion which says not only is it true, it was undisputed in the trial, according to Judge Marrero. $43 billion in savings. So that's the deal we're talking about. Process. The deal was announced April of 2018. The deal went through your typical Hart-Scott review process. The DOJ took over 15 months to review the transaction. The FCC also reviewed the transaction. Ended up with 30 million pages of documents delivered. Ended up with about 250 hours of depositions. Economists, engineers, lawyers scrutinized this transaction as carefully as any transaction that I've seen in a review process that took longer than the Empire State Building took to put up. Conclusions from both federal agencies, the deal was pro-competitive. Why was it pro-competitive? Because of the efficiencies that I've talked about. The ability to get more output from fewer inputs at significantly lower costs, and the ability, therefore, to take competition to the two firms that, by virtue of government largesse, AT&T and Verizon, who were handed spectrum to launch their networks, have dominated this industry from the beginning. The creation of a firm that can now take on these two industry leaders with better economics and a better network and bring real competition to bear. So since the deal was announced in April of 2018 and the deal was approved by the DOJ and the FCC in May of 2019, of course, you've all gotten the benefits of this transaction. You've all seen the dynamic competition that's been, in June of 2019, a minority group of states, 13 states, brought a lawsuit to block the deal after all of this process, after months and months and months of review by the federal agencies. Was that because there was an issue particular to any one of these states that could not otherwise be resolved? No. It was purely second-guessing the federal authorities, and at the end of the federal process, intervening to delay the benefits of this transaction even till today. The question that arises is that the way that our antitrust laws ought to work? And I guess I'm going to be a little bit provocative with my friend Sarah and suggest the answer to that is no. We should not be in a world where, after federal approval of a national deal implicating a national economy, implicating the movement of electrons freely across state lines, where a few states can come in and exercising parens patriae authority, block the deal. Why? Because by doing so, they are depriving the other 37 states of the benefits of the transaction. I'm going to back up a little bit and get a little more highfalutin here. I'm going to start by saying that I am a firm believer in federalism. I would say with the exception of Bruce, I would put my state rights credentials up against anybody in this room. Bruce goes a little bit further than I might go. Nonetheless, the fact that one is in favor of the sovereignty of the states, unless one wants to dissolve the union, doesn't mean that there aren't some areas that ought to be confined to the federal government. And I think this is one. So my wife says I watch too much television. On the other hand, my grandmother used to say, I watch TV and I learn something. And I was raised to listen to my grandmother. I recently watched a great television program called A More or Less Perfect Union, Monday nights, PBS, 9 o'clock. And one of the things I learned in that brilliant program, and by the way, if you have kids, kids have got to watch that program. I don't think Howard Zinn appears in that program. It's a great lesson in American history. One of the things I learned was that the reason we have a country is because before the United States of America existed under the Articles of Confederation, states were putting up roadblocks to interstate commerce. They were being protectionist. And one of the great goals of the U.S. Constitution was to create a national common market without state-by-state barriers. This has been reaffirmed in decisions by Justice Alito, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It is generally acknowledged in that the Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the Dormant Commerce Clause are designed to protect a national economy. Well, the Sherman Act is also predicated on protecting this national economy, protecting competition, not allowing individual states to set up protective barriers that keep that competition out. And one might ask, what could be more of a national market than the movement of these electrons through the air on airwaves that the government, the federal government, has a proprietary interest in? It is the federal government that licenses these airwaves. Why should a particular state vindicating its own policy, however sound or unsound that policy might be, why should they be able to stand in the way of a determination by the FCC that a transaction is in the public interest, not only because it promotes competition, but also because it provides broadband services to rural communities that don't have broadband services, not only because it promotes competition, but that it puts the country at the forefront of the 5G revolution, creating new jobs in high tech and improving our national economy? Why should a single state or even 13 states, and putting aside the District of Columbia, which is supposed to be a federal entity after all, why should they be empowered to come into court and to block such a transaction? I would argue that they should not be. and that transactions that are so directly relevant to the national public interest ought to be immune from suits from the states to block that transaction. If the federal competition authorities and the federal sector regulators have determined that the transaction is pro-competitive. I would also add that this is not just theoretical and hypothetical. And with all the respect that I have for people like Sarah, for Kathleen Foote in California, for some great antitrust lawyers that work for the states, it is a matter of fact, observable fact, that states will occasionally or often, depending on your point of view, use the antitrust laws to gain advantages for their constituents to the detriment of the other states. So in the T-Mobile case, for example, Nevada settled the case. Part of that settlement was a commitment to employ at least 450 workers for 6 years at a call center located in where? Nevada, as opposed to California or Arizona or New Mexico. Colorado settled the case on the condition that DISH agreed to put its wireless headquarters in Colorado. Texas settled the case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem is, again, and this goes back years. You can go back to the Russell Stover case when I was at the FTC the first time around, where a state will bring a case, a merger case, ostensibly to vindicate competition, and then we'll resolve that case in a way that provides an advantage to its state and, by inference, a disadvantage to the other states that have not so settled. I would also add that we ought to have an antitrust policy that is nationwide. It can be more aggressive or less aggressive. People can debate that. But the notion of having the most aggressive state making the decisions about mergers that affect the entire country, I think, is not good economic policy. It's not good. It's not good governance, basically. So,
Counsel, I think we have your argument.
Okay. can I just make one other point?
We'll save some time for rebuttal.
Okay.
So we turn to a federal authority that may not share the degree of enthusiasm that you've expressed for federal preemption.
I think that's right. I think, certainly maybe directionally have some similar thoughts here that I'll share today, but might not go quite as far as George has down there. But let me first start with the standard disclaimer for government participation on these panels, which is that I am here speaking on my personal behalf today and not on behalf of the Antitrust Division or the Department of Justice. And with that out of the way, I have to say that I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk about state enforcement today, and particularly the relationship between state and federal enforcement, because I think if you have been reading or hearing about the relationship between state and federal enforcement recently, you probably have come away with the view that there's a pretty major gulf between the two. And I actually don't share that view. I think more often than not, we have a lot more in common, and we approach our merger reviews, our conduct reviews, our antitrust analysis in much the same way. And I think the fact that we're able to do that is why we're able to work together with the states so often. I think at any given time, we'll have a minimum of 10 or 12 cases at the Antitrust Division alone where we have a confidentiality agreement signed with the states and we're working closely and cooperatively with them. And I think that is a relationship that really serves both of us well. And I think that really is the vast majority of the cases. But as George has just discussed, there are some times where we do have some divergences between state and federal enforcement, and we do have to wrestle with the issue of how that how those conflicts should be resolved. I think many times the differences between state and federal enforcement arise out of circumstances where the relevant authority of the state enforcer and the federal enforcer differ slightly. So the first of these is illustrated by the T-Mobile-Sprint transaction, and that is the Antitrust Division's role as a nationwide law enforcer. And so I won't go into too much detail because I'm sure you're familiar with it, and George has already given the broad recap, but this was a situation where the federal government, the Antitrust Division, reviewed the transaction, and decided that the merger should go through as remedied by comprehensive divestiture. We moved in the district down here in D.C. to get that settlement approved, and were joined in that by a number of states. A number of other states sued in the Southern District of New York, seeking to block the transaction nationwide. And in order to ensure that consumers actually receive the benefits that we saw as coming from this transaction and the divestiture, the Antitrust Division and the FCC filed a brief in the state's litigation up in New York, trying to protect those interests. And I know that that brief got a fair amount of attention, so I want to be very clear about what it did and didn't say. That brief certainly did not take the position that the states do not have the authority to sue under the federal antitrust laws. That brief also did not take the position that the states do not have authority to seek injunctive relief when they sue for violations of the federal antitrust laws. The only thing that brief said at all on state standing was to explicitly recognize that that standing does exist. What the brief did say was that in the rare circumstance where you have states seeking relief that is inconsistent with and would actually undermine the relief already secured by the Antitrust Division, that the federal court must take the federal relief into account when deciding whether an injunction for the states would be in the public interest. This is not a new position. This was the position that the Antitrust Division took the last time that there was a divide between state and federal enforcers on a specific case, and that was about 20 years ago in the Microsoft litigation that Judge Ginsburg is very familiar with. But this one played out in the district court, actually, where the Department of Justice and several states wanted to settle the case for and accept certain agreements to settle the litigation. But a group of other states wanted to move forward and continue litigating and seeking additional relief. And again, in that case, the Antitrust Division filed a brief explaining this distinction, stating that the states had standing to proceed forward with their suit, but that if the court was to consider further relief, it needed to be consistent with the relief already obtained by the federal government. So I think this position recognizes the key difference that George hit on between state and federal enforcers, and that is that state enforcers enforce on behalf of consumers within their own states. The Antitrust Division enforces on behalf of consumers nationwide. So where there's a conflict between the remedy that the Antitrust Division is seeking and a state is seeking, the federal remedy should control. Otherwise, we're allowing states to, or we're allowing one state to dictate the remedy nationwide for all other states. And so I think our role as a national enforcer is one thing that distinguishes us from state enforcers and sometimes causes us to have a different view. The other thing that I think is a little bit different about federal enforcement is that the Antitrust Division has a very active criminal enforcement program. The states, some states have under their state statutes the authority to enforce antitrust laws criminally. It tends to not be an area that has, in recent history at least, been used very often. And at least in any regard, there's no ability for state enforcers to enforce federal antitrust law criminally. So when we're looking at criminal enforcement, we're talking about certain per se violations of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. And included among these agreements are naked no-poach agreements between competing employers. So these would be agreements among employers to not compete to try to attract and hire employees. The Antitrust Division has actually been at the forefront of explaining why these types of agreements, these no-poach agreements, are actually indistinguishable from classic market allocations that the Antitrust Division has prosecuted criminally for decades. The reason that they have been in the news a little bit more recently, though, is the Washington State AG has been very active in attacking no-poach agreements within franchises. So these are slightly different in terms of their scope. Rather than being an agreement between two fast food chains, two different brands, to not hire each other's employees, these are actually placed in the franchise agreement themselves and prevent a franchisee from trying to hire from another franchisee. The Washington Attorney General has been prosecuting a number of these and is bringing civil actions and has been arguing that these types of agreements should be treated as per se unlawful. The Antitrust Division takes a different view of these and again filed a brief in one of the Washington AG's cases to explain its view of the per se application in No Poach Matters. Our view is in the franchise context, these are vertical agreements that are subject to the rule of reason. This doesn't mean that we think that they are necessarily lawful, but it means that Supreme Court precedent requires that we at least look at whether there are any pro-competitive benefits and whether there are any output-enhancing effects of these agreements before we either decide to uphold or strike down these agreements. You might be wondering why the Antitrust Division cares about how the Washington Attorney General chooses to bring its civil cases in matters that the United States is not participating in. And I think the answer here is that clarity and consistency in the application of the per se standard is really essential to our ability to enforce the laws criminally. It's really important for us to have clear lanes and bright lines and to understand at the outset whether conduct is going to go down a criminal prosecution path or a civil enforcement path, because our obligations at the Antitrust Division are different depending on which path we choose. You know, I think this is a situation where both the state and federal enforcers are enforcing the same laws for the most part, and if we end up blurring the lines in our civil enforcement, that can have potential implications in our criminal enforcement as well. So I think that's just another example of a situation where our different authority and the federal focus on criminal as well as civil authority might lead to us taking more of a bright line, rigid view in terms of how we're looking at the application of the per se rule. So I will wrap up with that and just kind of loop back to where I started, which is to reiterate that I think there's a lot more that state and federal antitrust enforcement have in common than that separates us. But I think where you see the differences, they tend to be noteworthy, either involving our criminal program or issues that might have nationwide scope. I certainly hope that those differences don't distract us from the overarching commonality of our enforcement regimes, though, because I do think that the enforcers, the parties, and the consumers as well all benefit when we work together.
Thank you, Andrew. Bruce, you had some advanced billing from George. You want to live up to it?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll try to exceed it. I'm really happy to be. I really wanted to be on this panel because it was the only panel I think I'll be able to say in an antitrust context that I'm going to be a Brandeisian. I'm going to talk about Brandeis and the curse of bigness. I think what people forget is that Brandeis, people have said, oh, yeah, well, that means we should be worried about tech firms because they're big. But he was also a bigger Federalist than George, and he was worried about largeness in terms of the government. And so, he's famous for his laboratories of democracy statement in New State Isis Liebman, you know, where he described how a state may, if citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel and social economic experience without risk to the rest of the country. And the last part is really important because I think the question that we have here about state versus federal power in antitrust or generally is really about how you allow states to do, you know, novel experiments or novel approaches to antitrust without sort of interfering. And I think both George and Andrew suggested this, without sort of interfering in sort of national policies and having the effects of the state enforcement or state policies spill over into other states. And one of the things that I want to focus on has a little bit different focus is that one of the things that really struck me in my time at the FTC was we had a hospital merger, and one of the first things that somebody showed to me was this thing, and I know you can all see that, but this is from the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. Massachusetts has this commission, which they basically look at healthcare pricing and the like. And if you go to page 49, trust me, but it's on the web. They have a willingness to pay analysis of the transaction of a hospital merger between Beth Israel and Leahy. It's done by Corey Capps at Bates White. We, of course, at the FTC, you know, we do hospital mergers. I mean, that's one of our big things. We have some amazing economists who do the analysis. And, you know, our economists, we had one of our better staffers put on it, and he did his own WTP analysis. There were some differences, but got the same thing. And then we staffed it up, the BC staffed it up, and in the end, you know, Massachusetts decided to put on a behavioral remedy, and the FTC did not bring an action. And you know, that was the first time I uttered the words federalism inside the building, because it seemed like I mean Debbie said when in the previous panel when they were talking about clearance and DOJ FTC fights. It said, you know, what would really be stupid if you had two agencies do the same investigation of the same transaction? That would be such a waste. And that's what really was happening. And I want to also sort of tie something to that Rohit, Commissioner Chopra, said, was that, you know, sometimes I think our job is to say no. And George is sort of talking about preemption. And I'm sort of want to talk about sort of the other side of the coin is that we ought to leave some things to the states. I mean, before McLean and Summit Health, you know, the federal government probably would, you know, in some sense not have jurisdiction over a completely in-state transaction. And I'm not asking to go back to the pre-Summit Health days or, you know, have Wickert v. Filburn overturned, but you know, I think one of the things that we face and what really drives sort of my thinking on this is that the resource costs of these investigations are really high and duplication. And these are cases where we really don't have that big of a disagreement on sort of the analysis. I mean, we ought to leave a lot of things to the states when the effects of those transactions are largely or are mostly felt within that state. And so I guess where people will start shaking their heads, you know, states, including my state of Virginia, where Sarah is, you know, they have a certificate of public advantage. And so her office is not a big fan of those, I believe. The FTC is not. We had a workshop, but I mean, to the extent that a state wants to do it, what they should do is tell us. We will just shut down the investigation if I control things, and then after it's done, we'll throw a 6B at them and study the transaction. And that gets us back to Brandeis. I mean, that's really what you want. We do retrospectives, and we do a lot of hospital retrospectives. And we do that to learn, and it really is something where if somebody wants to do something novel, they internalize sort of the anti-competitive effects of their actions. I'm actually really happy and encourage them to do those things. And the hope is, of course, that when even when they do their sort of COPA review, that they make the right decision consistent with us, but. Or consistent with the FTC because I'm no longer there. But I think one of the things that we have to think about just resource-wise is not only sort of when we preempt the states, I'll leave that to George to make that argument, but also, you know, when the federal enforcers decide, you know, not to do stuff. So, you know, when there's a four-station, gas station overlap in upstate, you know, well, just New York, we just sort of send an email to the New York State Attorney General and say, by the way, you ought to look at this, and it's yours. Will that help George and T-Mobile Sprint? Yeah, it'll keep them busy because, you know, they'll have to put some resource costs into it. And it's if you're thinking about sort of an overall layer cake federalism, you know, or dual federalism system, I mean, that's how I would sort of divide up, you know, the powers. So.
Finally, Sarah, you have a lot to comment on if you want to.
I do have a lot to respond to here. So first, I want to thank the Law Review staff and the George Mason Law School staff for inviting me to be on this important panel today. I think it's good that we have a state enforcer who's actually going to talk about state enforcement. First, I have to issue a disclaimer that although I am the chair of the NAG Antitrust Task Force, any opinions I express here today are mine alone and don't necessarily represent those of NAG or any particular AG, including my own General Herring of Virginia. And actually, this panel is especially troublesome for me because as NAG chair, I do represent all the states, and that includes states that took no position in the T-Mobile Sprint merger and states who sided with DOJ or settled on their own in the T-Mobile Sprint merger, as well as the litigating states. And Virginia was one of the litigating states, so I definitely have two hats in this conversation. So I really don't want to spend too much time on the facts of the T-Mobile Sprint case, except to say that George, DOJ never said the deal was pro-competitive.
They
said the fix was pro-competitive, but the deal was not. Okay. But you saw in an earlier panel that about the divergence between the FTC and DOJ that it struck me during that conversation that our system has been intentionally set up this way to foster multiple viewpoints and enforcement. And it's not the unintentional result of some haphazard statute system. Bacon, I'm glad you're here. There was a comment you made earlier that said if the states had won the T-Mobile Sprint merger, that we'd have 53 different antitrust enforcers in this country. And I hate to tell you, but we already have 58. And it's the 50 states and six territories. They all have their own AGs. They all have the ability to bring their own cases. And I think one thing that most people can agree on in this country is we're not currently facing a climate of over-enforcement of the antitrust laws. Not with the current high concentrations that you see in so many different markets. So this is kind of an odd time to me to be making this this pitch that state antitrust enforcement should be in any way curtailed. States have the jurisdiction to challenge mergers under Sections 4C and 16 of the Clayton Act, which is the same jurisdiction that individuals can use to challenge mergers. And as a matter of fact, in 2018, a private company that was a horizontal competitor of a company that the government enforcers allowed to merge brought a Section 16 challenge and became the first private entity to successfully challenge a merger under the Clayton Act without government help. Not only that, but it was a consummated merger where the district court ordered a divestiture of one of the merged company's facilities, and the DOJ submitted an amicus brief during the appeal supporting the private plaintiff's right to bring the case. And I will mention, too, that it went well beyond any state's borders. The case was brought in federal court in Virginia, but one company is headquartered in North Carolina, the other is headquartered in Texas, and the divested manufacturing facility is in Pennsylvania. So this was not a Virginia local markets case. Nowhere in the Clayton Act or in any case law is there a requirement that the injunctive remedy sought be contained within a state's borders. Nor is that practicable very often. And why there would be a policy argument to restrict the states more than private plaintiffs in bringing merger challenges is really a mystery to me. The state's authority to bring antitrust cases is unambiguously supported by constitutional principles of federalism, by federal statutes, and by ample Supreme Court case law. And unless Congress wants to totally preempt the field of antitrust enforcement for the national authorities, there is a 10th Amendment argument that any restriction of a state's ability to bring a merger challenge is unconstitutional. Both the Sherman and Clayton Acts provide states with a cause of action. And since 1945, when the Supreme Court decided Georgia versus Pennsylvania Railroad, the court has reinforced a state's ability to bring suit to protect the economic interest of its citizens when anti-competitive actions have injured the state's economy. There, the court noted that the state need not wait for the federal government to vindicate the state's interest in the removal of barriers to the participation by the residents in the free flow of interstate commerce. California versus American Stores is also particularly compelling because it is a case on all fours with the state's case in the T-Mobile Sprint merger challenge. In American Stores, California challenge a grocery store merger after the FTC had filed a complaint and a consent allowing the merger to proceed with certain divestitures. The case was appealed, the California case was appealed largely on other grounds all the way up to the Supreme Court. But in its decision, the court held that each state has the right to make enforcements differing from other state and federal enforcers, and having multiple antitrust enforcers was not an afterthought, but rather an integral part of a congressional plan for protecting competition. States and private plaintiffs are also permitted recovery of attorney's fees, unlike the federal enforcers, under Sections 4C and 16 of the Clayton Act. Again, this was deliberately done by Congress and was intended to reiterate congressional encouragement for state and private enforcement. This is evidenced by the fact that Congress passed the Antitrust Parents Patriae Act in 1976, allowing such recovery. The act was introduced to, quote, improve and facilitate the expeditious and effective enforcement of the antitrust laws, unquote, by the states acting as parents patriae. And I will say that you know, the states in T-Mobile Sprint did take the federal fix into account, just as they did in Aetna Humana when the parties proposed a fix. Whenever there's a fix on the table, that becomes part of the merger review. And you do an analysis of whether or not the fix is appropriate or enough. And it was the view of the litigating states that the fix that was negotiated by the FCC and DOJ was not adequate. The states often negotiate additional relief beyond that obtained by the federal agencies, and most recently did it when Colorado obtained additional relief from what the FTC negotiated and the UnitedHealth-DaVita merger. And I will also mention that Commissioners Chopra and Slaughter only voted for the relief that the FTC gained in that case because of the Colorado additional relief. Two recent examples of states proceeding when a federal agency closed its investigation with no action are the Massachusetts AG Beth Israel Lahey hospital merger that Bruce just mentioned, and California suing to block the Valero acquisition of the only independent petroleum terminal left in the state after the FTC closed that investigation. The ability of the states to go beyond the relief obtained by the federal agencies is also settled law. In Broadcast Music versus CBS, the court stated that a settlement, even one entered at the behest of the antitrust division, does not immunize the defendant from liability. A settlement obtained by DOJ or the FTC does not bind the states, and more importantly, it doesn't bind the courts. This is the point that Judge Marrero emphasized in his T-Mobile Sprint decision, where he noted that he was tasked with independently reviewing the legality of the proposed merger and was not bound by the conclusions of the FCC or DOJ. He did give deference to their fix because they have expertise in the area, subject matter expertise, the FCC in telecom and DOJ in antitrust. But his analysis was independent, and he said it was not bound by any notion that they represent the national public interest more so than any state. States are important enforcers of state and federal antitrust laws. Getting back to my original point of there not being over-enforcement of antitrust laws, states fill in gaps in enforcement by the FTC and DOJ. Only the states and private plaintiffs have actually brought significant product top cases, like New York's Namenda case and the multi-state Suboxone case that's going on right now. States also bring follow-on civil antitrust cases when DOJ is pursuing criminal cartel enforcement. This is especially important in areas like pharmaceutical drugs and our current generic drugs price-fixing cases, where state purchasers represent a very large percentage of national drug purchases. And so we are actually protecting our own state purchasers as well as our consumers. States also help fill out the law in areas like labor antitrust issues, even though we currently don't agree on no poach and non-compete clauses, but also in the state action area where, you know, we have NC Dental now, but there's not a lot of flesh on the bones there. And I will mention that state antitrust agencies also counsel a lot of our state agencies, so we try to fend off any competitive behavior before it starts. But I will agree with Andrew that my personal opinion is that the system works best and consumers benefit the most when states work with the federal enforcers, and we want to. States have a better understanding of local markets and of witnesses and third parties in those local markets. And I'll note in Anthem Cigna, every witness from Richmond, Virginia, which was a key local market in that case, thanked me for being at the table during their testimony and at their depositions. It seemed to have some kind of calming effect on them that I was there and could commiserate with them about the traffic on 95 going up to D.C. But and judges want to know if the affected states care about alleged anti-competitive behavior within their borders. And I can't imagine the FTC even trying to bring a hospital merger challenge anymore without having the AG's office of that state as a co-plaintiff. So I'll also mention that I'm getting older. I've been practicing antitrust as a government enforcer for almost 30 years now. And the state T-Mobile Sprint challenge is the first one of which I'm aware where there was a multi-state challenge in spite of a federal agency settlement. It's not something that happens very often. It's not something that we're seeking to do. The states had a separate complaint from DOJ in the e-books case against Apple, and we had separate economic experts. But we still successfully litigated that case together with DOJ and the Southern District of New York. So those things are also possible instead of just cooperating in their investigation. And we are currently working with both the FTC and DOJ now on some non-public matters and hope to continue to do that. So I will leave it there for now.
Well, it takes us back to